service availability. Weather in Washington, D.C. right now is 81 degrees and mostly cloudy. In New York City, 80 degrees with fair skies. For WPFW in Washington and WBAI New York, I'm Chris Bangert-Drowns. Thanks for listening.
Escuchando in Washington and all points beyond. This is Oscar Fernandez, and you're listening to Latino Media Collective here on WPFW 89.3 FM, Washington. El Distrito Colombia here on this Friday, July 5th, 2024. We're also heard on latinomediacollective.com. You can find us on Twitter under the name at LMC underscore show, and of course, live on WPFWFM.org. That's WPFWFM.org. Once again, this is Oscar Fernandez, and today on the show, we put the spotlight on the Joe Biden administration's executive order on migration and what it means for people seeking asylum in the United States. Last month, President Biden issued one of the most restrictive immigration policies ever declared under a recent Democratic administration. It will temporarily shut down the U.S.-Mexico border, deny asylum to most migrants who do not cross into the U.S. via port of entry, and limit total asylum requests at the southern border to no more than 2,500 per day. As of right now, organizations like the ACLU, among others, have filed lawsuits to block the executive order. All of this comes as Republicans continue to ramp up fears of escalating numbers of people migrating to the U.S. Yet our guest today will break down the reality of Biden's executive order and how it actually serves the vitriol of the GOP towards migrants. And so with us on the show today is Ernesto Castañeda, who's the director of the Center for Latin American and Latino Studies and the Immigration Lab at American University here in Washington. He joins us on the show today. Welcome to the show, Ernesto Castañeda.
Thank you very much, Oscar. Great to be with you.
Absolutely. It's a pleasure to have you with us today. So since the beginning of the Biden administration, the Republican Party has been screaming about the border being out of control with large numbers of people crossing. And to no surprise, the language that they use is rooted in racism and xenophobia when mentioning drugs and crimes and things of that nature. However, you told the Institute for Public Accuracy the following, quote, the current number of border crossings are much lower than in 2023, but still higher than 2,500 daily. These new quotas exclude various groups, including people who arrive with previously scheduled appointments made with CBP One app, more on that later, and the app used by Customs and Border Patrol, end quote. Could you explain how the realities of the border don't necessarily fit with the hysteria that we've been seeing from Republicans? Because in addition to the statement I just read to you, you also mentioned that a Border Patrol, which tends to overcount people in Mexico, could be the ones managing the list. And that's assuming that we even know who's going to be counting the entrances to begin with, correct?
That is right. That is right, Oscar. So a lot to unpack here. And you already mentioned the highlights, but let me dwell a little bit in each of them. So first of all, you're right. The first executive order that Biden did of this last combo, he has done others, but these latest two ones are the ones we're going to discuss today, is worrisome. First of all, because it limits the right that people have to ask for asylum in the U.S., something that is legal in the U.S. immigration law and that the U.S. has committed to respecting in international treaties. So it's part of the international law that the U.S. party to. Therefore, Biden, with a lot of pressure from Republicans and from his advisors, trying to appease the right, and we can talk about that later, they did put this arbitrary numerical limit on how many people can come into the border, numbers that are relatively low. But what this does is that it shows that the U.S. is willing to question again its commitment to asylum seekers. And we're talking here about a Democratic administration. And it also, as you were saying correctly, Oscar, there is threat or the, and now it's a policy tool that the White House of any party from now on until this executive order is repealed, that the border can be closed to asylum seekers. And that is tragic. That's what happened to a lot of people, including Anne Frank, who came to the U.S. in boats to the East Coast asking for refuge, escaping the Nazis in Europe. They were sent back, and we know what happened to Anne Frank and many of them. So we said never again as an international community, as the U.S., and we're willing to do it again. This journalists, people persecuted by organized crime, their governments, the political refugees, families trying to escape threats to them. And rather than listening to their cases and going through the process and then adjudicating whether they have a valid fear of persecution, where they can document it, it's already very strange. It's very hard to get asylum in the U.S., and this varies where you're coming from in the world. Your politics and other things play a part of it. But even limiting the ability of people to apply for asylum or to apply for asylum fully is something that is worrisome for protectors of human rights. That's what the ACLU is suing against this, and for other people that believe in the principle of asylum. Some right-wing conservatives say that this right has been abused and that's why it has to be curtailed. But there's very little evidence for that. Indeed, most of the flows lately are, rather than coming undocumented or trying to pass undetected, that is caused by the limited amount of avenues that people from Mexico, people with quote-unquote low skills or low education can come legally. There's very few avenues. So many of them were coming undocumented for a while. But we have seen lately that most of the people are turning themselves in, not as criminals, but saying, hey, here I am, that's my name, I'm from this country, I want to apply for asylum. That's why it's easier for the authorities to count. And that's why we have these lines of people in the U.S.-Mexico border waiting for the line in the queue to get processed. Like Republicans were saying some years ago that if you wanted to immigrate, you had to do it legally and you had to get in line. That's exactly what people from Central and South America are doing right now. And still, the Republicans are not happy. So again, it's impossible to appease these demands when things change on the ground and the Republicans are still thinking about this 1980s supposed threat that ended. Mexican migration is now net zero. More Mexicans leave than they come. That was never the invasion that people fear about. Spanish is still not the official language of the U.S. But those fears, that fear-mongering, it continues with us to this day, and now it's affecting asylum seekers. A couple things on the numbers that you were also mentioning.
Yes.
In December of 2023, there was a supposed maximum of around 10,000 people per day. If there was a lot of overcounting, probably it was the highest. But even if we extrapolate that and we say, okay, what happens if all that people come here through the year? We're talking about 3.5 million people trying to enter to ask for asylum. So that's one thing. But then even the people that are let in, it's not like everybody can stay. So if you're coming from Pakistan and then the government determines that you don't have a legitimate claim to asylum because you just want a job, they may deport you. And different independent organizations have looked at the data, and it seems that Biden has deported more people per month, the Biden administration, than the Trump administration did. So a lot of the people that come in, even the Haitians that came in that were under the bridge some years ago, that also made a big splash in the news, many of them were deported in airplanes back to Haiti. That was stopped by the Biden administration. And that was the last announcement that now Haitians can apply for TPS. That was less covered. That was a positive thing. But again, with the Biden administration, we've seen some steps forward, one step back, some steps forward. But then what is get caught in the cable news is very different from what's happening in the White House. And then what's happening in the ground is very different from what the public discussion and what people in the public understand, because a lot of technicalities. So even if it was the 3.5 million, that again, it's not true because over half of them are going to be deported. But 3.5 million people in a year represents 1% of the U.S. population, which is around the amount of people that we need for the U.S. population to keep growing. Because we're at a point in time where the American population is stable. So if it's not for immigrants, the U.S. population will go down, which some people say we don't care, as long as it's quiet, it's fine. But then that means less workers, it's going to mean less economic growth. So people have to make a choice. But one of the reasons we came out of the crisis of the pandemic economically, without the migration that has happened, we wouldn't be as strong economically as we are as a country, as an economy. We know that inflation is an issue. We know that poverty is still an issue, inequality is still an issue in the U.S. That is true. A lot of the benefits, a lot of the checks, a lot of the support and the active role that the government had during the height of the pandemic with both Trump and Biden, that has disappeared. And a lot of people are missing that and say, hey, where did the state go? That is an issue. But we are out of the crisis, economic crisis that the pandemic created. And the U.S. is the number one of that because of the good actions of Biden and because of immigration. And just real quick, the increase also at crossings in 2023, which we don't see anymore this year, the increases were because we had an exception in history, which was Title 42. The first time the U.S. crossed the border,
yes,
for an extended period of time, with the reasoning was public health concerns because of the pandemic. So Trump did it. There's a lot of statements by Miller and others in the Trump administration that was a way to close the border and limit immigration as they always wanted, legal and illegal, even asylum seekers. They were stopped because of the fear of the spread of the coronavirus. So that was, okay, you can say that was a good reason to stop it. Biden, when the pandemic was declared over, he had to reopen the border, so we did. So then people asking for us, wanting to ask for asylum, were in Mexico and Central America, stopped waiting for the U.S. border to reopen so they could come and present their claims. So it was literally a bottleneck. So when the border is open, the people that were waiting to present their cases, because they didn't want to come undocumented, many of those, they came. So obviously there was going to be a surge, but it's not limiting enough. So then by the numbers, you have to look at the big picture and say that the numbers are not historical, they are not of control. The opposite, we probably are having the most managed and most orderly and more visible migration in U.S. history right now.
I hope the audience understands that while at first glance, it is very easy to compare these recent actions by the Biden administration to that of Trump, we could also make the argument that this is a continuation of Obama's policies when it came to migration. He was referred to as the deporter chief, you know, during the second half of his administration as well. So that's food for thought right there as we continue this conversation. So in 2018, you wrote a book with Daniel Jenks entitled Reunited Family Separation and Central American Youth Migration. I bring up your book for two reasons. One, a few weeks ago, I did a show about a Guatemalan grandmother who was separated from her grandson. And I'll tell you the same thing that I told the audience at the time. There has yet to be an official declaration by the current administration that the family separated by the zero tolerance policy have been reunited. It is still an ongoing problem. There's been no official declaration that issue has been resolved. And number two, there's a component of Biden's executive order that excludes, quote, people with young children and unaccompanied minors that I think needs further explanation. So, for example, last month, Democracy Now! Interviewed Arizona-based reporter John Washington on unaccompanied minors, and he said the following that I think needs worth repeating. So let's take a listen.
This rule does not apply to unaccompanied minors, which potentially will lead to sort of something like coerced family separations, where parents, and I've seen this firsthand, who are bottled up in northern Mexico and are waiting to try to do it, quote unquote, the right way, realize that there actually isn't an option, or that they'll have to wait months or more, and so they will send their kids across alone, and then they themselves will try to make a claim later on.
So that was Arizona-based reporter John Washington speaking to Democracy Now! About the unaccompanied minors component of this executive action. So, Ernesto, I want to get your thoughts on what he just mentioned there, because it does sound, according to how he described it, sort of a backhanded, sneaky way of family separation, a very indirect version, which we were so much against during the Trump administration.
Yes, Oscar, great point. And John is right. So the executive order on the asylum seekers at the border between points of entry from June of this year, that executive order limits who can come in, but it has exceptions. So if you do CBP-1, you are not counted towards that quota. If you are from Cuba, Haiti, Venezuela, Nicaragua, you're not counted on that quota because there's a particular process for you. If you are coming with another type of humanitarian permission, you're not counted. If you come to the ports of entry, you are not counted. If you are a minor, if you are an accompanied minor without your biological parents next to you, or an adult that is claiming to be your legal guardian that is over 21, you're an accompanied minor and you can come in because there's special protections. As long as you're not from Mexico or Canada, you are allowed in the U.S. and you're counted towards that quota. Because of all these exceptions, probably that quota won't be reached because there's these kind of exceptions. And the immigrants, I think, are maybe self-measuring or self-regulating and entering in small chunks at a time so they don't surpass the quota and they don't close the border on them. And again, we've seen that before. It was called metering, that people from Haiti and other places were doing informally in Tijuana, for example, so that the amount of appointments available every day to ask for asylum, they were being met, and then people were waiting in Mexico, and that was part of the consequences of remaining Mexico policy. And then what John was saying happened, remaining Mexico, people were waiting for months and months to get their appointments so they could come in as a family unit. So then we saw images, we saw reports, we saw testimonies of people sending the kids alone, throwing sometimes even babies across the border so that the kid could come in and be in the U.S. and stay and reach the American dream while the parents will figure out how to join them later. So that's a very hard situation where the parent is made to choose the one, my young kid, my young daughter, teenagers particularly, to suffer in Mexico, sleep in the streets, maybe be kidnapped by organized crime, be persecuted by the gangs, or I want to send my head of the U.S. because I cannot do it with them. We cannot do it as a family. So that is this incentive to self-separate as a family and migrating in tranches or piecemeal. So that's what John is talking about. And again, it's a real phenomenon happening with a small number of people. Although, well, traditionally, we will see working-age men coming to work, or women, as nannies, et cetera, coming to work and leaving their parents, the children behind in their towns of origin, the countries of origin. The data reported by the Border Patrol says that more and more there's family unit, meaning there's a father, a mother, the two parents with a small child coming together and asking for entry together. So we see more families on the road, so then this situation is more common. And then what we also talk about in the book Reunited that you mentioned with Daniel Jenks, we write about how immigration law, the way it's written, and again, for the lower of the labor market, because if you are an engineer, if you're a scientist, a diplomat, a banker, you can come legally with your family with visas for everybody. But if one is an agricultural worker, low skill, low education, you may get a temporary work visa. You can come alone, or you may be tempted to migrate undocumented. And then traditionally, people will leave their family behind not to expose them to the risks of the trip if they are not persecuted by the police or their lives are not under threat. And also, you are sending money back home so that they can actually use the dollars to go further buying food, etc. But that is another type of family separation that is created by migration policies that want workers so they can send remittances and workers are willing to leave without their families for they think it's going to be a year, 2 years, but in reality it becomes 10, 14 years, that a biological parent is separated from their biological kids because of the immigration system that we have that exploits and takes the immigrant labor at the expense of family unity. And this is something that the immigrants decide on their own to do, so it's not forced by the state like Trump did at the border, physically, forcibly separating families in front of each other's eyes. But de facto, it creates the same thing. So the big surge in accompanied minors that we saw in 2014 and that we saw before and we keep seeing is to a large degree teenagers many teenagers that their parents have been living in Washington, D.C., in the DMV for 10, 14 years, and they were back in El Salvador, in Honduras, Guatemala. They're coming on age, and I'm like, there's no future for me. I cannot go to the university here. The gangs are trying to recruit me. I'm going to go live with my mom in Maryland. So then they were coming in 2014 and since. So again, this separation for years has important effects and important mental health and other implications for the family unit and the individual experiences. So family separation, we have to understand it in this more comprehensive definition.
I feel like we could do just a 1 hour conversation on sort of this class divide as to who can migrate and who can get visas a lot quicker than others. And this form of family separation, because it's not under the umbrella of zero tolerance and not carrying with it the vitriol of the Trump administration, doesn't get the same attention, even though the same thing is happening, as you just mentioned. So another component of Biden's executive order that was also at the center of controversy last year is the CBP mobile app. Now, last year alone, asylum seekers and immigrant rights groups pointed to the app's glitchiness. It was also referred to as Ticketmaster for asylum, which gives you an idea of how problematic it is. So migrants also had to submit a photo for their application. But according to PBS's San Diego affiliate, KPBS, the app failed to capture images of migrants with dark skin tones as well. So this process is also based on the assumption, we have to say, that all immigrants have smartphones and that all migrants speak Spanish, which is clearly not the case. I mentioned to you that grandmother who was separated from her grandchild. She was an indigenous Guatemalan whose first language was neither English nor Spanish. And even Amnesty International stated last May, as recently as last May, that the app, quote, violates the rights of people seeking asylum in the United States. What are your thoughts on this continued use of this app for asylum applications?
So after the end of Title 42 on May of last year, 2023, there was the worry by the right, many commentators, and some people in the Biden administration, that there will be too many asylum seekers suddenly arriving at the border, and it will be an administrative nightmare. That will be really, really hard for Border Patrol and even all the staffing that they had to process all the people to come in or not, which is an administrative. It's not as national security people are not armed, they're not a national threat, they are not terrorists. But administratively, it is a lot of people to process. So the Biden administration had this real conundrum in terms of logistics. It's a logistics issue more than anything for homeland security. It's not really about national security. So they came up with different ideas on how to divert or how to organize these flows. So as you mentioned earlier, for geopolitical reasons, they were willing to say that the situation was really bad in Haiti, that people had a credible reason to escape. And Nicaragua has a regime that it's against, or there's a lot of tensions, we could say, between the U.S. administration and the president of Nicaragua. So they were willing to declare that, which then Nicaragua has used politically in a very interesting ways to send immigrants on purpose to try to block and allow people from China and other countries to come without visa, to make, allow more people to arrive to the border as a political tickle, if you want, of the U.S. So they had a special provision for them. And again, under geopolitical pretenses, they also were easily quick to recognize that people escaping Cuba and Venezuela had a reason to do it. Obviously, it's much trickier to say the same for people coming from Mexico or from Colombia that are closer to the U.S. in terms of cooperation with immigration, for example, and other things that is harder for the U.S. to say that the situation is so tough in Mexico that people are guarantee warrant asylum. that would create a big demand for asylum seekers from Mexico. That hasn't been traditionally what has happened, that they are granted, even if people are sometimes really escaping persecution, violence, etc. So one of the solutions, when I say, one solution was to create this program for four particular people, that they could be sponsored, have family members here, etc., and make it's always been easier for Cubans to come here. So that continues, and that takes away some of the pressure of people arriving between ports of entry at the wall, which again makes the news, and it looks bad that people are lined. Another possible solution that people imagined in Washington was the idea of, right nowadays, right, we want to solve everything with an app. Some things are better with apps, sometimes it doesn't work, right? So this was an experimental pilot project that they accepted from the beginning, that they were going to use an app to try to manage arrival at the borders to be more organized. It follows the law, but it was part of the reopening of the border after Title 42. There were all these policy programs, some of them very progressive, some of them very interesting, some of them more like tech fixes, like the app that I'll tell you a little bit more in a minute. But also there were positive things in there. For example, there was the idea that it's also a pilot of opening offices in Guatemala, in Colombia, so that people from other countries could go there, a U.S. asylum processing office where you could ask for asylum in the U.S. without having to cross Mexico. And risking your life and in expenses and all that. So that's a good idea. It hasn't really taken off, or it hasn't been done at a large scale because of all the technicalities and all the staffing, et cetera, that it needs. But the other idea was the app. So it's like, okay, you can come and present yourself in a port of entry with a ticket, with a price, but rather than you, depending on the list that people are taking by hand in the U.S. side of the border, that, you know, you can be... people can pay to get ahead of the line. You can make favors. You can favor a country of others. There were some issues like that people were complaining about that in Mexico. So the app was supposed to be a way to schedule an appointment. That's easy as that, right? The problem was technical, but more in the sense of the design of the app. So first of all, early on, you couldn't apply for an appointment at the border port of entry unless you were in northern Mexico.
Really?
So you have an incentive, a lot of people in southern Mexico, Central America, to get and be in Tijuana and all that to try to make an appointment. But then you have thousands of people sleeping in the streets of Tijuana because they're just with the point so they can access the app, it will recognize Tijuana and they can make an appointment. But because the appointments were limited also, there was this random cap. I don't remember exactly, but I think it was something like around 200 appointments per day, which the U.S. government said, okay, that's what we can credibly say that the staff people in the port of entry in San Diego, in San Isidro, in El Paso, they can tramit the staff we have without any budget from the Congress. We can tramit 200 people per 200 families or individuals per day. Which, okay, that's the limit. So they had that money, that amount of tickets. But then you had a couple million people waiting for that appointment. So that's when you have 1 or 2 million people for 200 slots in one particular. Again, there were many different entries, but still, you have a very small proportion of the tickets available, not for the concert of Taylor Swift, but to ask for asylum, and then people asking for one. So they were crashing the app all the time. That's what the Ticketmaster thing, because the probability that you're going to get an open slot is really low because the huge demand. The only one is the technical thing. You have to be close to the border. You have to have a smartphone, which, funny enough, a lot of the immigrants do have, but you have to have a strong signal or pay for it, or have a Wi-Fi, and then it's another reason that you may go to a shelter or not. The logistics on the ground become very twisted around the app use that the app designers didn't have in mind because they didn't know how this would work on the ground. And then there were technical things that the language, for sure, a big issue. What languages you can use the app for, absolutely, but you have to read, not have to read them right. That is also not universal from asylum seekers from around the world. And then you have to, again, answer in a very bureaucratic ways without consulting a lawyer. That could be confusing for some, although that wasn't so much an issue. But then, yes, you had to take a photograph and you had to report that you were in the right place at the right time. And yes, as you say, many people have reported that people with dark skin, they were not recognized by the app to take the photograph and upload it. So people from Haiti and others had issues that you could say that there was a racial bias in the design, that again, it was tested with more fair-skinned people, maybe brown people, but not with darker folks. So they didn't see that glitch until it was implemented and all that, and it was de facto discriminated against people. But then there were all these negative incentives. So now you have the app. For example, now you can also apply from Mexico City. So a lot of people are establishing themselves in Mexico City, getting temporary jobs and all that, living in parks in Mexico City, which is becoming polemical down there, while they get their appointment, which now it can take you months. as a family, you can be waiting 6-8 months to win that lottery. They also call it a ticket master because it's like winning the lottery. It's like, oh, you're going to get lucky enough and you got an appointment. And once you get your appointment, you're going to travel from Mexico City and go to Tijuana or one of the ports of entry. And the organized crime knows that now there's going to be foreign-looking people coming to come into the U.S. legally, and they have to do it at the time of their appointment, but they will lose their spot, and they had to wait who knows how many more months to get another appointment. So they are being targeted by organized crime and some corrupt police officers in Mexico who say, hey, going to your appointment? Okay, yes, so $1,000 right now, or I won't let you cross. And then you are desperate to pay that money so that you can make your appointment. So it's creating all these extortion opportunities in northern Mexico that were not intended. But again, SONAT is not going to solve the problem. But the main problem here being the limited amount of people, that the limited amount of appointments that are open up every day. It's not enough for the demand. So it was never going to be the solution.
You know, this whole madness with this mobile app, along with the quota that's being imposed on asylum seekers, I think also points out to the fact that there's been billions of dollars invested to militarize the border.
Yes.
There's been billions of dollars to set up prisons and facilities for migrants, but very little has been invested as far as administrative people that could have alleviated this quota that's being imposed on asylum seekers in the first place. So it's just a huge mess, and we've only just scratched the surface in this conversation. But right now, we're speaking with Ernesto Castañeda, who's the director of the Center for Latin America and Latino Studies and the Immigration Lab at American University right here in Washington. This is the Latino Media Collective here on WPFW 89.3 FM, Washington. We're going to take a quick break right here. Back with more in a minute. Stay tuned. That was Los Tigres del Norte, and you're listening to the Latino Media Collective here on WPFW 89.3 FM, Washington. Reminding everyone that you can follow us on latinomediacollective.com. You can also follow us on Twitter under the name at LMC underscore show. That is at LMC underscore show. And of course, live on WPFWFM.org. That's WPFWFM.org. Once again, this is Oscar Fernandez, and we're speaking about Biden's executive orders on asylum seekers with Ernesto Castañeda, who's the director of the Center for Latin American and Latino Studies and the Immigration Lab at American University right here in Washington. So, Ernesto, in response to a CBS News poll on deportation following Biden's executive order, you stated the following on Twitter, quote, "Restrictionism is largely a dog whistle for some conservatives with ethno-nationalist design for the future of the U.S., end quote. I want to know if you could elaborate on how this executive order, which is meant to appeal to Republicans, isn't necessarily going to convince people to vote for Biden in any way, shape, or form. As a matter of fact, several representatives in Congress have stated that. Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez has stated that doing Trump impressions isn't how we beat Trump. This is what she said on Twitter. In addition to that, Pramila Jayapal from Washington said, quote, "Democrats cannot continue to take pages out of Donald Trump and Stephen Miller's playbook. We need to lead with dignity and humanity," end quote. And ACLU attorney Lee Gallant took it a step further and said the following, quote, "An executive order denying asylum based on where one enters the country would just be another attempt at the exact policy Trump unsuccessfully tried and will undoubtedly end up in litigation." Your thoughts here?
Yes, Oscar, I agree with all those tweets that you read and the statements provided. And what I meant by mine was that, yes, it can be tempting for a politician to try to appear tough on the border or on immigration so that they are not outflanked by the right. And a lot of people know Europe and the rise of right-wing, contrariously anti-immigrant parties. Right now in the news, France, the Rassemblement National, the very racist party, had the biggest amount of votes, around 30% in the last election in France that just happened. But what I tell the audience, my readers all the time, is that is true. But again, we're talking about 34%, which is a lot if you have a lot of parties, like in France, in Belgium, in England. But in the US, with a two-party system, you can win an election with 34%. And the base of the MAGA base of the Republican Party is around, I will say, 34%. The hardcore Trump base MAGA is 34% of the electorate. And then it's very much benefited by the Electoral College and the way our voting system, that is not a popular vote or a 50-50. So that's why the elections get very tight. But it's a minority of the people. But the people that are anti-immigrant and they say build a wall, most of the time are not people that are in border counties. They are not in New York City. They're not in Washington. They're not in places where actually we had a lot of immigrants from around the world that are part of our communities that make all these benefits for where we live. They are for, I mean, it's not as a step, but it's true. The data and survey show that. So Montana, South Dakota, North Dakota, very white places, rural places. Conservative, that's fine. Both Republican, that's fine. They're afraid of a border that they don't live with. And they're the ones that really believe kind of what they hear in Fox News and other things about the border being under threat. And some of the retirees from those regions, veterans and others, they're the ones that volunteer to go and guard the border as citizens, like the Minutemen and all these guys in the past, are people that are not locals for the most part. They're not the local ranchers. Some of them do, and I mean, they can say they have a claim, blah, blah, blah. But a lot of these is people coming from the regions where you don't have as many immigrants, believing this fear-mongering, and then wanting to do something about it as good citizens. And again, the danger that we have in the world today, to think that countries are only real countries if there's a perfect overlap between a nation, meaning a people, meaning a blood, whether you call it French, English, American, whatever that means, and a government that represents that people that share blood. It's a very Nazi belief, eugenics, which is an ideology that starts in the US,
yes,
and Australia and silver colonial countries that want to keep America, California, Oregon white, and that's in constitutions, that's in plans. And again, who is white and what that means changes through time. It's something very malleable. but now Italian Americans, Irish Americans, some people from Latin American origin that have been here for many generations have become white de facto and buy into this. But there's also a religion component now. Until now, people from North Africa and the Arab world are technically white. But because they're not Christian or are seen as Muslim, they are not seen as being part of the American identity by the people that are against immigration. So that's what I mean, that it's a national program, and it's to a big degree a Christian nationalism. They want America to be very religious, very Protestant still. And we have these real moves in the South of Louisiana to have the Ten Commandments in the schools.
That's right.
This is a government, it's a project government of like erasing the boundaries that are already soft between government, state, and church in the U.S. They have a project that they want a country that represents their beliefs, this evangelical belief. So for those people, they wrongly see people from the global South, even if they're religious, even if they're evangelical, they see them as a threat to their project of a nation that is Christian and is white. And Muslims are a problem. They have been a problem for a while, since 9/11. Very public, very problematic. Asians are a problem, even if they're highly educated, doing very well by other metrics. And Jewish people are also scapegoated, while Israel is seen as a symbol for a second coming and all this part of the ideology that becomes together and meshed with a political project that the Republicans and Biden and Trump has been very successful in taking that evangelical vote to see that he is the one advancing that agenda. Even if he doesn't live by the Bible, he is the one that is willing to make those political projects a reality. And he has delivered to them with the Dobbs decision, right? Making it harder to have abortions, not for public health reasons, not for scientific reasons, not for the choice of the mother and the family, but for religious reasons. That's why he did it. That's why they like it. So again, when people say, some people say, I'm against immigrants, I'm for a border wall, deport these foreigners, part of it, some of them may have a real concern about they don't want disorder in the border, they want people to come in a legal way, they don't want people to quote-unquote break the law, and these arguments, they may believe wrongly that immigrants take away jobs from others, which is not true, but they may believe that. That is fine. There's a lot of misinformation. But for many others, that is a dog whistle to say we want to keep America white. And again, Trump has given many of examples that that's what he means. Because he's married to an immigrant, that's not an issue. His mother is an immigrant. His grandfather is an immigrant from Germany. These are the good countries, right? He said, why don't we have more immigrants from nice places like Sweden instead of these Est places in the Caribbean and with people that are Black or Latino. So it is a racial project that Trump is selling to his base, and the base is buying. So that's why this, the whistle is a problem. And that's what is not enough for the Democrats to say, okay, we're going to close the border to asylum seekers over this amount, and we're doing something about it. Or we are going to pass a bipartisan bill, we're going to spend more money in judges and infrastructure in the border. They don't care about that. There is not really about immigration or legal migration. It's about a distorted view that thinks that people of color cannot have the same political, economic lives that everybody else in America has. And we have been producing Americans for generations of different parts of the world. So somehow they think, and again, it's not something that we saw this 100 years ago, the Know-Nothing Party believe the same, that the Germans coming speaking German or the Catholics from Italians, Southern Europe, were going to destroy America as they knew it. It changed, but it was going to change anyway, but it didn't stop being the English-speaking America that they knew and loved.
And unfortunately, this is only going to get worse. We've seen it in horrific examples like the El Paso shooting back in 2019, the mass shooting in Buffalo, the Pulse nightclub shooting, among others, too numerous to mention here on the show. And so it is a scary direction, and it's also scarier to see it that it's replicating itself in various parts of Europe as well as we have this conversation. Now, what also bothers me about this is this sort of racism and xenophobia is masking the economic conditions that lead people to migrate in the first place. So, for example, in May of last year, you wrote an article for The Conversation that pretty much predicted the direction that the Biden administration has taken with these executive orders. Around the same time last year, news outlets were reporting on an increase of migration from Cuba, Venezuela, and Nicaragua. As you know, these are countries that often become wedge issues because of the long geopolitical history the U.S. has with these countries going back decades and generations. But few outlets pointed out that U.S. economic sanctions on these countries may be exacerbating the problem. And whenever this issue of U.S. sanctions comes up, I always want to remind people that sanctions can kill. Economic sanctions can kill. And one example that I'd love to give out is Iraq back in the 1990s, the no-fly zone during that time period, because a lot of things that were being banned in Iraq with regards to sanitation and public infrastructure was banned during that period, and it led to all sorts of malnutrition and people migrating, again, migrating during that time period. And so I bring this up to you because, considering the work that you do, to what degree can we measure economic sanctions on these countries in playing a role in people seeking out asylum? Because we also have to make it very clear that while you and I are very familiar with the long geopolitical history between the U.S. and these three countries, we can't assume that every asylum seeker knows the same history as you and I do. Most people are just hardworking, working class people who are trying to deal with situations that are beyond their control.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely, Oscar. For example, in the case of Washington, D.C., why do we have so many people from El Salvador, Guatemala, and Honduras? In the 80s, for example, before, but at least in the 80s, there were civil wars in many of those areas where the U.S. was a silent or not so silent partner for the sometimes authoritarian regimes oppressing the population that just wanted better land reforms, better distribution of resources, less corruption, etc. And by the strong repression that happened, many people had to escape for their lives, and they came to D.C. when they were, and San Francisco and other places, when they were into churches, diplomats, ambassadors, artists, people connected with Central America that helped people come in another type of the Underground Railroad that we don't talk about, but it was getting people to these hidden channels out of danger in Central America and into safety in the U.S. And they were considered by the actors of this movement, the sanctuary movement, as refugees, even if the U.S. government couldn't recognize them as refugees or grant asylum so quickly and easily, because they were partners and they were collaborating, they were sending support and training to the regimes in northern Central America. So that's an example of why people are here, because we were there before. And that's why we have now the third or fourth generation of people coming here, because there's family members here that came because of intervention of the U.S. Same with Cuba and Venezuela. I mean, there's no doubt. Cuba is a place that me and my other colleagues have done a lot of research on. I was there for the first time last December, and it is indeed sad how hard it is to buy food on the market. I mean, there was no market. The government used to provide its citizens a basic canasta, a basic set of goods that people could collect with a booklet, going back to some of the features of communism. But now the economy has been suffocated by the conditions, by COVID, by the lack of international support, and by the embargo to such a big degree, and the economic reforms that the government has tried to do haven't worked, and it's hard for them to work, that now the government cannot really guarantee enough food for its population. Even foreigners coming with U.S. dollars, you go now, there's private stores that have opened as a way for entrepreneurs to make a living. But because of the embargo, there's very few products that you can buy. And the ones that you can buy are relatively expensive. You can only afford them if you have U.S. dollars or, you know, euros or Canadian dollars. Who can do that? Tourists, which they haven't recovered the tourism numbers since the pandemic. They've been halved. And because there's not enough supplies, the tourists, they may go to a restaurant and there's no Coke, there's no lime, there's no lemons, there's no this, there's no that. So they are not going to come back because they cannot have this service of all-you-can-eat buffet that they can get in the Dominican Republic or Mexico, etc. So then what is the other avenue for people to do is to receive remittances from abroad. If you have a family member in the U.S. sending you money from Miami, you can buy food. You will get food, you won't starve. Again, people are not starving, but they are really, really, really struggling to get basic food on the table of their families, which embargo does, it's not the only cause, but it doesn't help at all. And if the embargo was lifted, it's not like the regime will become strong and survive for another 100 years necessarily, but it'll be easier for the average Cuban or Venezuelan to make ends meet and less pressure to migrate for economic reasons. Because right now, one of the only solutions to get your family out of poverty is to migrate. So a lot of young people, working age, professionals are gone. Even in Havana, the cities are very quiet. There's very little economic activity. There's very little vibrancy because over 1 million people have migrated. It's a small island. in the last couple of years is a lot of people, that Cuba is losing people well-educated, healthy, that the regime has been investing in them. Now the U.S. reaps the benefits just so they can send a few $100 a month to their family members that very much need that. So yes, these foreign policies and the embargo are producers of immigration in countries like this. So yes, we cannot untangle foreign relations from migration. And let me go back real quick to your previous question and the statements that some of the people were making on Twitter, that to copy the book of Trump is not going to help defeat him. We see, for example, in Belgium, in the Netherlands, that a center party was trying to do that with the further right. And what happens is that, as some people said, you want the original. You want the original racist, the original person that became the head of anti-immigration or racism. You want to vote for that person, not for the copycats from the center. The same thing happened to the prime minister in England that wanted to kind of outflank the right wing, the Farage and this new nationalistic party, and allow Brexit to happen, thinking that he would win, but with a very anti-immigrant campaign and making it so that Brexit won. And then those guys are basically out of power. Boris Johnson, all the guys that campaigned for Brexit, they lost power and control really, really quickly. Probably the party's going to be voted out very soon. So it doesn't work on the long term to be anti-immigrant or to try to become more anti-immigrant than the anti-immigrant people. And not because Biden had this very strong, or Obama had these millions of deportations, hoping he would appease the right so they could do an immigration reform. That didn't work, right?
Yes.
For Biden, he did this at second order, trying to close the border. It's not like the Republicans were clapping or thanking him or say, okay, the problem is going to get better. He's not getting any credit from that or any borders from the MAGA base. So why do it? And there's no longer the Ukrainian aid or the Israel aid. That's why they came up with this bipartisan agreement, which was very much a Trump-line policy. Now that Trump walked away from it, it was a political solution. It's going to be a little more money spent on enforcement rather than the infrastructure and the personnel and the processing power that we need at the border. So let it go. But Biden announced this. It wasn't that popular with nobody, left, right, center. Nobody liked the mentoring. It wasn't enough, or it was too late, or it was limiting the rights of people. And in contrary, this executive order allowing people who graduated from colleges to stay, even if they were not initially beneficiaries of DACA, or the spouses of citizens, that has been a very popular policy that hasn't cost him any votes and may win him a few votes. And even the Republicans and the restrictionists, even the racists have had a hard time arguing for that policy, because these are people that are married U.S. citizens, many of them white. They have U.S. citizens' kids born in the U.S. All these people are going to work. Many of them are in the military. Many of them are graduated from a university. It's harder to make that argument. So then people are thinking about deportations, but I don't think they're thinking of deporting those people. I think when people hear deportations, I think they're thinking of, I catch you illegally in the border, which again is more rare now. I catch you at the border and then I return you. I think that's what a lot of people have in mind when they're saying deportations, rather than moving people from their working places in Washington and other communities.
We're just about out of time, but we certainly hit on a lot of important issues as it pertains to unaccompanied minors, the geopolitical miscalculations of this decision, these executive orders, as well as the mobile app, which has been problematic in and of itself. But I want to end this by saying that you really crystallize how the economic conditions that the U.S. imposes on places like Cuba, Venezuela, and Nicaragua is exactly the sort of thing that exacerbates the issue that we've been discussing here. You know, all these separate things that we discuss are greatly important. There's no doubt about it. But if we don't...
On Wednesday, July 24th at 11 a.m., people are gathering from around the country to surround the U.S. Capitol and demand the arrest of Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu for war crimes in Gaza. In a new low for Congress, it is inviting Netanyahu, the subject of a warrant request at the International Criminal Court, to speak. This is at the same time that he is committing a genocide. Tens of thousands of Palestinians, overwhelmingly women and children, have been murdered, and schools, hospitals, houses of worship, and residential neighborhoods have been leveled by increased bombardment by Israel, which is also blocking food, water, and medicine in a siege of starvation and death. On July 24th at 11 a.m., the American people will surround the U.S. Capitol and demand the arrest of Netanyahu. More information, including about transportation, is at shutitdownforpalestine.org. That's shutitdown4palestine.org.
Hello, WPFW.
Summertime is here. Words Beats in Life and Arts for Everybody have the event for your family and friends this season. DMV Made Festival is happening Saturday, July 27th on the National Mall, a one-day celebration of the D.C., Maryland, Virginia region, promoting the intersections of arts and culture, plus health and wellness, featuring musical acts, Chuck Brown Band, Sweet Honey and the Rock, Substantial, Belladonna, DuPont Brass, and just added, The Blackbirds, celebrating 50 years of their classic, Rock Creek Park, plus four more music and dance stages, Family Fun Zone, Poetry and Storytelling Pavilion, live art installations, hands-on workshop tent, and health and wellness pavilion. Free to the entire community. July 27th on the National Mall. DMV Made Festival. Get more information and RSVP today. WBLINC.org/DMVMade.
For WPFW in Washington and WBAI New York, I'm Chris Bangert-Drowns with some brief news headlines. President Biden's campaign chair insisted this morning that he is staying in the race against Donald Trump, while acknowledging, quote, some slippage in support. Four more House Democrats called on Biden to step aside this morning, writing in a letter that it is time, quote, to pass the torch to a new generation of Democratic leaders. New Mexico Senator Martin Heinrich this morning became the third Senate Democrat to call on Biden to drop out, saying he should, quote, secure his legacy and safeguard the future of our democracy. Yesterday, Adam Schiff of California became the highest profile Democrat yet to publicly call for President Biden to back out. A majority of Democrats think Vice President Kamala Harris would do a good job as president, according to new research from the AP and the NORC polling firm. But only about 30% of voters broadly think she would do well, and half say she would not make a good president. In an opinion issued this morning, the United Nations' highest court said that Israeli settlements in occupied Palestinian territories are illegal under international law, and that Israel must end settlement construction immediately. It also said Israel must make reparations for damages caused by the occupation. It marks the first time that the International Court of Justice, also known as the World Court, has delivered a position on the legality of the 57-year occupation. The ruling is non-binding, but can play a significant role in shaping international opinion and could lead to greater sanctions against Israel. In Jerusalem yesterday, Israeli National Security Minister Itamar Ben-Gvir visited the Al-Aqsa Temple compound to pray for the release of hostages and the continuation of war without compromise. The Hilltop Temple compound is deeply significant to both Muslims and Jews, and frequent visits by the ultra-right, pro-settlement Ben-Gvir are seen as contentious by many people, even inside the Israeli government. This most recent visit comes as Ben-Gvir continues to use his political influence to steer Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu away from seriously contemplating ceasefire proposals. As a critical coalition partner in Netanyahu's cabinet, Ben-Gvir has the power to pull his party support for the government, dissolving it and triggering new elections. Netanyahu remains deeply committed to maintaining his coalition, making the prospect of a rift with Ben-Gvir unlikely, and casting doubt on whether ceasefire efforts are viable. Wall Street Journal reporter Evan Gershkovich was convicted and sentenced to 16 years in prison today on espionage charges that Gershkovich, the Journal, and the U.S. government all deny. The trial in a Moscow court lasted a little over a year. In a statement, President Biden reiterated his position that Gershkovich is wrongfully detained and promised that his administration is, quote, pushing hard for Evan's release and will continue to do so. Gershkovich was the first U.S. journalist taken into Russian custody since 1986. Russia's top diplomat, Sergei Lavrov, said earlier this week at the UN that Russian and U.S. officials are discussing a potential prisoner swap involving Gershkovich. The U.S. first offered to swap Gershkovich last year, but Russian officials said no swap could occur without a conviction. And a massive computer outage is disrupting a range of services globally, from airports and hospitals to news stations, banks, and internet providers. The outage is linked to a software update from cybersecurity firm CrowdStrike, impacting a large number of computers using the Microsoft operating system. CrowdStrike CEO George Kurtz told NBC this morning that the company knows what is causing the outage and is working on a solution. The pace of the fix is unclear, but Germany's IT security agency chief said it would not come very quickly. A Microsoft spokesperson said earlier today that it was, quote, observing a positive trend in service availability. Weather in Washington, D.C. right now is 81 degrees and mostly cloudy. In New York City,